Hey, you're listening to the wrong podcast. Topics today include cars, cameras, and conversations.
Wrong! You're going to disagree. That's the point. Yeah. It's the wrong podcast, but we'll make it right. Spinning the world in a whole new light. Witty, wild, and a little askew. And the one who's right, it might be you, it might be you. The Wrong Podcast.
Hi, I'm Tim. I'm here to talk about politics, culture, religion, sports, and anything else you're not allowed to talk about in polite company. Issue number one! Pay attention! Hey, have you heard the term groiper? What about edgelord? Do you know what edgelording is? Let me tell you, you need to know these terms, and I'm here to help. You've probably heard the term trolling, right? Trolling, we're familiar with that one. That's an internet term. Trolling is when you harass somebody online and you keep pestering them. Edgelording is similar to trolling, but it's a little bit different. It's when you do something provocative. You say something outrageous so that people pay attention to you. It doesn't matter if it's out of bounds, if people hate it. The whole point is to get people to notice you because you're brave enough and strong enough to say something outrageous. And these two terms, trolling and edgelording, they kind of represent a group of people known as groipers. And for sure, other people troll and other people edgelord, but groipers are really into it. And groipers are people who listen to this guy, Nick Fuentes. Nick Fuentes he's a internet celeb. I've talked about him in the past. He's got a podcast, YouTube show, he may not even be allowed on YouTube. I don't know. But he is an isolationist. He's a nationalist. He claims to be a Christian. I don't know that he represents anything about Christianity in particular, but Christianity is at least useful for him in his nationalist pursuits, and he is a anti-Semite. And groipers are people who listen to Nick Fuentes and are into what he's doing and are trying to help him out. And one of the things they do is they go to Turning Point USA events. They go find Charlie Kirk talking to college students, and they ask outrageous questions. Or they ask Ben Shapiro outrageous questions in public venues, trying to push the idea, their ideas, that the Jews are bad, that there's conspiracies going on, and that America needs to be protected from outsiders. The reason they do this is because of something called the Overton window. The Overton window is a window of things that are appropriate to talk about. And the basic idea is that you want to shift the Overton window. If it's okay to talk about things from the 20 to 80 spectrum, well, you might believe in something that's at the 85 point on whatever topic we're talking about. And so to get people to start talking about that 85 idea, you start talking about something at 90 or 95 on this scale to shift the window so that people are more willing to talk about your extreme ideas and move them towards the center. So you talk about something extreme. And it's kind of a weird term. I still couldn't really identify where the term came from, but it has something to do with a bad drawing of a frog with his hands underneath his chin, with his fingers interlocked underneath his chin. Weird image, and that's part of the appeal of it, is that it's weird. And this whole movement is kind of nihilistic. It wants to burn everything down. It's very anti-establishment, and it identifies greatly with probably the worst ends of the MAGA spectrum. Not everybody in MAGA is a groiper, clearly, and I don't think Donald Trump is an anti-Semite in any way at all. But these people see something appealing in Trump and have been supportive of him. And Rod Dreher is a conservative columnist. He's pretty influential and not without some controversy himself. He's a Christian. And he has been saying, hey, classical liberalism is on its way out. And we Christians, we're going to be in trouble when that happens. Freedom of religion is going away. So we need to side with the people who are going to protect us, even if they're not our ideal. And he kind of got behind Viktor Orban in Hungary, who was a nationalist, not a American nationalist, a Hungarian nationalist. And that didn't go great. Orban was quite corrupt, and Dreher has even said, yeah, I didn't factor in all the corruption that would come with nationalism and populism. Well, recently, Dreher is out talking about a new book that's coming out soon, and he just started talking with this other guy, Jeremy Boring. Is that right? Yeah, Jeremy Boring. Wow, that's quite the name. I think I would change that name if I was a podcaster. I wouldn't go with Boring. Maybe he pronounces it Boring. I don't know. Anyway, he has this interview with Jeremy Boring where he talks about a conversation he had with J.D. Vance about Groypers. And I'm just going to play this clip for you, and then I will include a link to the full interview because it is fascinating.
You've written about and even spoken here about your trip to D.C. and speaking to young Zoomers who are working within the government, working within the administration, and you say 30 to 40% of them, and you know, and growing. I would add, and growing, seem to adhere to this nihilistic worldview of sort of despair and revenge. It's not a constructive tear it all down. Who represents them politically?
Heavy sigh. I had hoped that J.D. Vance would be the
guy with whom you were friends.
It was an interview I did with him in 2016 for the American Conservative that launched his political career. It was an accident, but it went mega viral and boom, he was suddenly a best-selling author. We stayed friends after that. I don't know that we're friends anymore. He cut me off after I went to visit late last fall to talk to him about this very thing. Now, I'm not going to disclose our conversation, but I will just say that I pointed out to him these people, the Fuentes, the Groypers, all of them are going to destroy conservatism and the Republican Party. And I said to him, because of your background, because of your age, you're uniquely positioned to draw a red line there, say, no, we are not going to accept that. And I asked him to do it. It's not my position to say what he said, but I will say firmly, unequivocally, I do not think J.D. Vance is an anti-Semite. I do not think he's a racist at all. But I've written a couple of things since then calling on him to please be a leader, take a stand, you know, take a stand for your own Christian beliefs, for your own wife, for your, but he hasn't chosen to do it.
Issue number two, gone to the dogs. So Doge has pretty much shut down, and Elon Musk has said it was a mistake. It's gone. Doge was the Department of Government Efficiency, and it was funny because it's an acronym that rhymes with a funny way to say dog. And Musk was behind this crypto coin called Dogecoin at some point. He was really enthusiastic about it. And so he named this government program after this meme. And it that was about as much thoughtfulness as went into the program. The idea was that, hey, there's a lot of waste in government and inefficiency, and we can cut all that out. We can fire people. We can make sure that real money is going to real places. And Musk got in there and started shutting things down, and people started complaining. And when they complained, he said, I found it. Only somebody who's ripping off the government would be complaining about their program being shut down. And people are going to go to jail. Well, nobody went to jail. A lot of the programs were silly. They are silly. But a lot of the stuff was real. And it turns out it's wrong to cancel contracts on people when you have a contract. Unless you have fraud, you should not cancel contracts. That's a bad idea because you're going to get sued. That's going to end up costing you more money. That's what happened with Doge. It didn't work. And the main problem with it is it wasn't conservative. And some of you are like, of course it was conservative. It's getting rid of government waste. What could be more conservative than that? And there, it certainly is conservative to get rid of government waste. I'm a big fan of that. Please do that. Please. But the way you do that, the how you do that, also has to be conservative. And it was not a conservative way of doing things. There is something called Chesterton's Fence. G.K. Chesterton, he was this British author in the 19th century. I'm going to make you do the math when that was. And probably part of the 20th century too. I don't know exactly. I'm also confused about when the 19th century was. I'll just be honest. But he said, if you come across a fence, you should not knock that fence down until you figure out who put the fence up and why they put it up. There's probably a good reason this fence is here. Don't just knock it down because it's in your way. And that's conservatism. Figure out why the fence is there. Why is this government program here? Why are there 20 people instead of 18 people working on this project? It could be that absolutely you can fire 5 of them, no problem. But you better be sure before you knock the fence down. All that to say, I found a way to get over on the California state government. And I will tell you how to get over on the California state government because it is incredibly inefficient. We are paying at minimum 75 cents more in gas taxes than the rest of the country, or at least most of the country. And I figured out where some of this money is going, and I got it back. And I'm going to tell you how to get it back. So the lovely Wendy, and she got this, we got this letter, and it looked like junk mail. I was going to throw it out. She happened to look at it, and she goes, Tim, I think you should look at it. It says the California Air Resource Board wants our car. They want to borrow our car. And I was a little bit skeptical about it. It had a website address you can go into and, you know, input this code. So I went to the website address, put in the little code, boom. Everything California might know about me through the DMV was right there on the screen. And it had an offer. It said, we want to borrow your 2017 Toyota Corolla, and we will pay you $2,000 a month while we have it. It shouldn't be more than 2 months. And we will, and if it's less than 2 months, we'll pay you for the full 2 months, and we will give you a rental car the whole time, and we will return the car to you washed with a full tank. And I pretty much called these people and said, how soon can you take the car? Because that sounds like a great deal to me. Please take my car. Go do your smog testing. And they said, we're going to be doing smog testing on it, you know, to make sure it doesn't produce pollution. If it fails, it'll be no problem for you. We're not going to fail your car just because your car is failing. Great. Take my car. Give me the $4,000 minimum for taking my car. And twice they notified me that they would be returning my car, but did not return my car, which the first time this happened was a little troubling, but I was getting checks and the checks were clearing. So whoever took my car and gave me a rental car is at least sending me money. And twice they said, hey, your car is done. It'll be back in 2 days. And it wasn't back. And this went on for 3 days short of 8 months, and they finally returned my car. And who knows how many miles, people are asking me, how many miles are they putting on your car over this 8 month period? And I said, it doesn't matter to me because the car is worth $10,000. And after the 5 month mark, they had bought the car. I don't care if they put 100,000 miles on it, they've paid for the car. They're going to give it to me back. And I'll get something out of it, plus the money they've already given me. So this went on 3 days short of 8 months, just shy of $16,000. They returned the car to me, and they had driven it about 50 miles away to the laboratory, and they had driven it 50 miles back to me. And aside from that 100 miles, they put an additional 300 miles on the car. inside of a lab on one of those little tracks, the little car treadmill things that Lightning McQueen warms up on, 300 miles, not on the road. 100 miles on the road, and they paid me almost $16,000. If you want in on this, help yourself. The trick to this is randomly getting selected and getting a letter from the California Air Resource Board. There is no way I can refer you to the program. There is no guarantee you'll get into this program. You probably won't because California is a very populated state with lots of cars. The one thing you could do is get a rare car. They want to test every make and model of cars. And apparently that's why I got in as quickly as possible, because I knew that a Toyota Corolla was a popular car, but they said, no, your car is rare because it hasn't had any modifications to it. So don't modify your car anywhere, by any measure. Don't change the muffler, keep it stock, and just hope and pray you get one of these letters. And what drove me nuts about this is, why did they have to have it for 8 months? They could have, if they couldn't get to the car for 8 months, why didn't they just reach out a month ago? Why did they wait 7 months to actually test my car? Just call people when you need the cars. That seems to be a great way to save some taxpayer money. But no, that's not what California is about. And in this one instance, I don't mind. I don't mind at all. Here's the real kicker. The guy who returned my car to me, he said, it's not unusual for them to call people back two or three times once they've run tests on their car. And the reason for this is that my car, they have data on it, and they can compare that data to future data. And it could be that the Toyota Corollas start failing, and they will reach out to Toyota and say, hey, there's a problem with all your Corollas. We're going to have to do a recall. And Toyota will say, well, you just tested this other car, so why don't you call them back and get their car again, because we know that car passed. And so for this reason, I need to hold on to this car for the next several years because it is a moneymaker. Hey, it's time. What are the rules?
Oh, what are the rules? What are the rules? Don't touch my fries or my garden tools.
I was recently on Twitter and I noticed J.K. Rowling, she said something to somebody, I don't know about what, but I clicked on her profile and noticed that in her profile it says J.K. Rowling rhymes with bowling, not growling, which is interesting because I think mostly I've heard her name as J.K. Rowling, but she says it's pronounced J.K. Rowling, like bowling. And then also, I don't know if you've noticed, but Turkey has asked that we start pronouncing their country name as Turkiye. That's how we're supposed to pronounce it. That's the Turkish pronunciation of Turkey, Turkiye. And I've heard a few people do this, and I'm sorry, no. I'm willing to say J.K. Rowling. I am not willing to say Turkiye. Turkiye. I'm not doing it. No. I'm not crossing that line. And here's why. The English pronunciation of this country is Turkey. I'm speaking English. I'm not speaking Turkish. What with your delights and whatnot. We don't call it Nippon. We call it Japan. The Japanese people seem to be quite fine with the English pronunciation of their country being Japan, not Nippon. They get it. All these Spanish speakers in the world do not call it Germany. They call it Alemania. That seems to be okay because the Spanish word for Germany is Alemania. And in this case, the English word for Turkiye is Turkey. That's the rule. It's Turkey. And stop trying to be bacon flavored. Remember, I want to know what's wrong with you.
What's wrong with you?
If you'd like to submit a question, topic, or tell me how I was wrong, you can email me at listen at thewrongpodcast.com or submit a comment at my website, thewrongpodcast.com. And help me spread the wrong message. If you like what you hear, share it with your friends. Issue number 3, Feed the Beast. Hey, I have lots of strong opinions. I don't know if you could tell based on this podcast, if you've been listening for a while, or even in this episode alone, I have strong opinions. I'm not scared of sharing those strong opinions. In fact, I have some rather radical and extreme opinions that they are outside the political norm. Most people disagree with them. They are 15% kind of ideas, that there's only 15% of us who agree with me. I'm not afraid to have those ideas, those opinions. I'm not afraid to share them. I'm not afraid to convince people to follow along with me in those radical and extreme views. And let me tell you, that is super annoying to some of you. I get it, that I will not budge on this, that I will not compromise. It's super annoying. You found a way to compromise on this thing or that thing, or to get along with everybody, or to move forward with whatever the status quo is, and I cannot do it. I'm not compromising on some things, and that is annoying to people who figured out how to compromise on them. I get it. Super annoying. I'm not changing. My ideas tend to be conservative. I would say I am a conservative voter. I am extremely conservative, in fact. Now, the Republican Party currently is not extremely conservative, but people would say it's radical. And they would say, no, you're moderate. And the truth is, I am an extreme conservative politically, ideologically, but rhetorically, I'm a moderate. And I want my politicians to also be rhetorically moderates. And where I break with the Republican Party right now, most consistently, is on the rhetoric. It's not moderate enough. It's not intellectually humble. It's not conciliatory. It's not invitational. It's combative. And that is not who I am, and that's not who I think people should be, and that's for sure not how the government or our politicians should be, in my mind. And there are people who say, oh, you're effeminate. You are a coward. You refuse to confront evil because you are not willing to fight. There is only one way to push for your ideas, and if you are not being combative, you are giving up. You're conceding ground. And I saw this thing from this guy, and he is a former pastor, and from I don't know all the details of why he's no longer a pastor, but he left his job as a head pastor, and based on what he said, it seems at least in part he left because he was being asked to change how he talks to people. And this is what he said online. He was talking about something else. Basically, he was talking about how to talk about politics, and specifically how to talk to people on Twitter. And he said,
Twitter is not a place for polite pearl clutching. As I've tried to explain to church normies for years, X is combat. It's today's gladiator arena of ideas, big and small, as everything that eventually ends up downstream on Facebook and cable news always start first on Twitter. It's the place where ideas, narratives, and even policies are shaped. The Overton window that you're even processing my words through is usually determined in that space. And because it can be that existential and paradigm-altering, it is often bloody. How could it not be? Therefore, Twitter requires a serrated edge, a voice and posture that wouldn't be used in the pulpit or at the church picnic. And that's a good thing, despite what some pearl-clutching church marms would have you believe.
Wrong!
And just to prove my point, I gathered a number of scriptures that tell Christians how they are supposed to behave in the public square when talking with outsiders. 2 Corinthians 10:3 through 5.
For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ.
Galatians 5:22-26.
But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. Those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. Since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking, and envying each other.
Ephesians 4:29-31.
Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, with whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Get rid of all bitterness, rage, and anger, brawling, and slander, along with every form of malice.
Colossians 4:5-6.
Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone.
James 1:19-20.
My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. Because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires.
James 3:8-12 and 17-18.
But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse human beings who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers and sisters, can a fig tree bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness.
James 3:15-16.
But in your hearts revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander.
Proverbs 15:1.
A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger.
2 Timothy 2:23-26.
Don't have anything to do with foolish and stupid arguments, because you know they produce quarrels. And the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but must be kind to everyone, able to teach, not resentful. Opponents must be gently instructed, in the hope that God will grant them repentance, leading them to a knowledge of the truth, and that they will come to their senses and escape from the trap of the devil, who has taken them captive to do his will.
Now, there are for sure passages that speak harshly. They speak harshly about sin. They speak harshly about wolves who were invading the church. Jesus himself calls Pharisees to their face vipers. He says they're whitewashed tombs. Paul, talking about people who advocate for circumcision, he says, I wish they'd cut their whole manhood off. Clearly, there is room for harsh language and plain talk. But it has to be in the context of all these other passages that call us to speak gently and to speak wisely and to not use the weapons of this world. We have to do both, and we have to be wise about it. And as far as I can tell, For Christians, all of the harsh language is saved for people inside the group. When Jesus is talking harshly, he's talking to religious leaders. He's not talking to regular people on the street. And Paul, he's talking to people who know him well. He spent years with these people. There is a context for his harsh, plain language. And it isn't applied to outsiders. To outsiders, he speaks differently. And that's what I think should be happening with Christians. You want to go on Twitter and go for it and get into tussles with people? Great. The fruit of the Spirit better be evident in everything you're doing and saying. Advocate for any position you want, by all means. Don't back down. Be brave. Be courageous. But people better see love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, and self-control from you, and most of all, patience. Because you are not wrestling with people, you're wrestling with ideas. And people have been trapped by those ideas. Your job is not to tear down the people, but the ideas. And I don't want to psychologize people too much. I don't want to guess at what's going on. I'm going to do it a little bit, though, because I think that some of these people just can't. They can't adopt the fruits of the Spirit. There's something about them. There's some immaturity in them, or there's something about their brain is wired. They cannot be sanctified. The Spirit is not getting to their rhetoric, and they can't do it. And so when they see people saying, hey, you need to consider how you talk to people and how you go about making these arguments, they can't do it. And so they accuse you of being effeminate and of being a coward, because in their mind, that's what's happening. There's only one way to do this. They only know one way. If you're not going to do it their way, if you're telling them they can't do it this certain way, where they mock people and slander them and defame them and scoff at them and call them names, if you're not allowing them to do that, well, then you're not allowing them to make the argument at all. I'm imagining just empathetically, if I was told, hey, the only way to speak in church is to sing. We all have to sing, and we all have to sing like sopranos. I would be in trouble because I cannot do it. I would work at it. I would try to learn how to sing, but I'm never going to sing like a soprano well. It's just not going to work for me. And so I would argue against being that's the way we have to speak in church. I would argue against it because I can't do it. Problem I would have is if there's actual scriptural passages, there's actual Bible verses that tell me I have to do it this way. That would be a major impediment to my argument against it. And because I'm trying to conform myself to the Bible, I would have to conform. I would have to learn how to sing. And even though I can't sing in a soprano, I would have to do my best. That's the bottom line. It doesn't matter if you can't do this. You need to try, because that's what the Bible is calling you to do. And if you can't do it, then you need to stop. You need to get off Twitter. That's the bottom line. You are hurting your faith. You're hurting your religion. You're hurting Jesus. You're hurting the message as a whole if you cannot modify your tone. Trust me, I would love to get in on this stuff. It seems like so much fun, and I think I'd be pretty good at it. I cannot do it because the Bible has told me I'm not allowed to. And on top of that, I can't do it because I know it will corrupt my soul. I can't even do it for fun, because when you pretend to be something, you become that thing. I use satire and sarcasm and parody, and I say provocative things all the time. They're not completely ruled out. But there has to be a line where you do not attack people. You do not make them the objects of your scorn. This is not a right-wing thing only, by any means. There are people on the left. There are people on the extremes of every position who cross the line. And I've noticed recently that there's a lot of talk about socialism. There's a lot of talk about the Democratic Socialists of America, who don't identify as Democrats, but are trying to work to transform the Democratic Party in the same way that the Tea Party movement and the populist movement decided to jump onto the Republicans and use their platform to advance their ideas. The Democratic Socialists of America are attempting to do that with the Democratic Party, and they've had enough. They've been asked to wait because of Trump, because of the threat of Trump, because of the dangers of Trump. They've been asked to sit on the sidelines and not push for their extremist ideas because Trump needed to be opposed and everybody needed to be cool in order to get moderates on board with their anti-Trump message. And now that Trump is in the last 2.5 years of his term, they've had enough. No more. They're going to go for it. And they've got some radical ideas. And some of those people with radical ideas also have some radical ideas about how to get their stuff done. And some of it is over the line. It's violent. And it should be opposed. Most of all, it should be opposed by people who agree with the socialist ideas, because they're making you look bad. And when I hear people advocating for violence, I've learned that I don't need to listen to what they have to say about how to change the economy, because I'm going to instead focus on stopping them from advocating for violence first and foremost. They've made the conversation about violence. And I'm going to give you some examples here, and I am telling you, I am not nutpicking here. I know that you can go on Twitter and find people saying radical, stupid stuff all the time. I'm not nutpicking. I didn't go look for this stuff. This is stuff that came across my Facebook feed by a friend and people she knows, and this all seemed normal to them and the way things should be. So my friend, she posted this to begin the conversation.
I think every year the richest person in the world should be sacrificed and their wealth distributed to the poorest among us. The rest of the year, billionaires would scramble to distribute their wealth to ensure they aren't the one that's sacrificed next. Is that radical enough for you?
So this is somebody I know. I'm not looking for people to pick fights with, but I just said, hey, it is not cool to advocate violence against anybody. Period. And she modified her post. She said, you're right. I'm not advocating violence. That's not okay. Sacrifice just means, you know, there's other ways to sacrifice. It doesn't mean killing them. And I think that is nuts. I don't know how you can construe this as anything other than killing people. And her friends and associates, they decided to chime in and prove my point.
As someone who studied history extensively, I would argue that there absolutely is a time when violence is the answer. And I'm terrified to think how many of us have forgotten that.
That's right. He is terrified that we have forgotten that violence is the answer. That's what's terrifying, that we are abandoning the use of violence. That's terrifying. Someone else said,
do I think we should just start killing billionaires wholesale? No. But one does not become a billionaire by making good humanitarian decisions. Many of them have contributed to the deaths of thousands and the marginalization of millions more. They're happy enough to sacrifice the impoverished at the altars of their greed. How many of them made their billions denying health care or food or safety to people around the world? They may not carry weapons, but they are far more violent and deadly than the poor will be. Don't ever pretend the wealthy are peaceful. Ever.
And, you know, there's this idea that everything is violence. What you charge for health insurance is violence. What you choose to censor is violence. What you teach is violence. And No, not everything is violence. Violence has a very particular definition, and if you make everything violence, you've turned violence into nothing, and actual physical violence will be prevalent. And that is something you should be worried about, because it won't stop with you. There will be people who want to oppose you, who now have cause and reason to oppose violence because that you've put forward actual physical violence. There are two main issues with capitalism. There are two sins of capitalism. They are envy and greed. And the people who are focused on greed do not notice their envy. And the people who are focused on envy do not notice their greed. They both should be opposed. We don't need to keep the status quo. We can make whatever changes we want. Absolutely, there are things that need to be adjusted. There are holes. There are people who are being victimized. Absolutely, let's clean that stuff up. But not with violence. Violence is not going to be the way we get this done. Somebody just flat out wanted to correct me directly for saying, hey, violence is not okay. And they said,
funny how civility gets demanded the second people get loud about billionaires. That's the same tone policing playbook used on Jim Crow protesters, except now it's aimed at people mad about yachts while kids go hungry.
That's right. If you tell people that it's wrong to advocate for murder, it's the same thing as telling black people to stop advocating for civil rights. And then finally, I don't even know what to say to this person. They said,
billionaires should be hunted down and shot. And this should be everyone's opinion, because they are everyone's problem.
Wow. My heart breaks. No. As an American, no. As a human, no. This is not what we're going to do. This is not how we're going to talk about it. It's not. You're wrong. And I'm not wrong about this. But if you think I am, let me know. Let me know why. I had fun and I hope you did too. Bye-bye.
Wrong podcast.